and a bloody aggression that resulted in the death of 10 Palestinians and the injury of more than 100 others. The Zionist Occupation Army rained the streets of the old city of Nablus with bullets, where violent clashes erupted between enemy soldiers on the one hand and the resistance fighters of the Nablus Battalion and the Balata Battalion and the Lion's Den, whose fighters arrived in the old city in an attempt to break the siege on the resistance fighters under fire. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank in Jenin camp is Mr. Mohammed Jaradat, author, academic, and political commentator. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed, for being with us. Now, under American pressure, just days after the Palestinian Authority actually backed down from the draft resolution condemning the Israeli entity in the UNSC, the Zionist enemy committed a new massacre in the old city of Nablus, which basically prompted an automatic belief that this concession encouraged the occupation, this concession by the Palestinian Authority actually encouraged the occupation to commit this massacre, especially in the light that Tel Aviv is in denial of any binding understandings with Ramallah to begin with. But in all fairness here, when has Israel ever conceded to any agreement with the Palestinian Authority?
On the contrary, the Israeli occupier not only does not abide by the agreements, if he only did not abide by the agreements, it would have been half a misfortune for us, the Palestinian people, and the Arab and Islamic nation with this brutal Israeli occupier. The fact is that this enemy takes advantage of every agreement signed by the Palestinian Authority or any Arab or Islamic party with it, whether it is a normalization, political, security agreement, or even in trade and economy, exploiting it to penetrate the blood of the Palestinians. This is like the scene that took place in Nablus recently and before that in Jenin. And it takes place in Gaza every year or two. We also saw it at the crossroads in the town of Hawara yesterday. The town of Hawara was a great witness to their brutality. The small and meek town of Hawara, which is a commercial market through which settlers and soldiers pass to delve into Palestinian blood. The Israeli enemy exploits all agreements with the Palestinian Authority. When the Authority signed the armistice for a period of 4 months in order to stop the settlement expansion that ate whatever Palestinian land was left, we saw that this occupier attacked Nablus and plunged into its blood. We are not only talking about the martyrdom of 11 Palestinians, but rather about more than 100 wounded, most of whose wounds are serious. Nablus hospitals are still, until this moment, crowded with the wounded who require extensive surgeries. Therefore, the Palestinian Authority made a big mistake with these agreements. With the Authority going to the Aqaba security meeting, it made the second mistake within just a few days.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, yet also, to be also fair, the massacre in Nablus proved once again that the Authority did not consider 3 decades of panting behind the so-called peace with the Zionist entity and its agreements, and that it is unable to leave its actual comfort zone in which it has become stuck in reality. Even it is still trying every time the entity commits a crime, the Palestinian Authority tries to find some palliatives to the Palestinian anger. Doesn't that just motivate the Palestinians of the West Bank and the occupied Al-Quds as well to denounce the Palestinian Authority once and for all as unable to truly represent the will of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance?
This is what really happened. The Palestinian Authority has fallen between the jaws of the occupier, who is exploiting its weakness, and the angry, defenseless Palestinian people, who find what is going on, whether in withdrawing the complaint from the Security Council against settlements, or in going to the Aqaba security meeting where the maze is useless. This was formed in the awareness of these young men in Jenin and Nablus. It was formed in their awareness that the Authority participates with the occupier in security coordination, and in their pursuit of the resistance heroes who are trying to reach the sources of strength and brutality of the occupier, to strike him and to inflict retribution on him and his settlers as a result of every brutal massacre perpetrated by the occupation. This Authority, according to its organizational structure, is not qualified to get out of the maze into which it entered. When we talk about American pressure on the PA, or we talk about getting lost between the jaws of the wild right-wing coalition between the Likud and the religious Zionism, this Palestinian Authority is unable to get out of this political charade, and it also cannot change its nature, which was built on the basis of economic corruption and on the basis of marginalization of the honorable class in it. Yes, there is an honorable group in it. The network was built through some of them. But with the passage of time, gradually the crew who live on these economic gains like the Paris Agreement and whatnot began to distance themselves from the reality of the goals of the Palestinian cause. Even from the perspective of Oslo thought, or the thought of the PLO that signed the agreement to recognize Israel's legitimacy, the agreement for which we are still paying the price every day.
Well, it is very clear now that Washington will not be able, by taming the Palestinian Authority, to control the dynamics of the Palestinian street, who is boiling, has reached levels that are closer to an explosion than any other time in the past, especially after what we saw happened in Hawara yesterday. While the resistance in Gaza is also not far from the line of engagement, after we also saw missiles from the Gaza Strip falling on the Israeli entities' settlements just after the Nablus massacre. How likely do you think is a joint Gaza-West Bank operation in light of the constant Zionist violence against the Palestinians?
It is normal for there to be sharing and burden-bearing between the West Bank, Gaza, Al-Quds, and the occupied interior. And even with the access of resistance countries that support the Palestinian cause, who pay exorbitant prices for this support from their people, money, political stances, and the siege they are exposed to. On the Palestinian cause today, through the daily massacres carried out by the Israeli occupier, we see the Palestinians standing alone. This Palestinian citizen, whom we saw yesterday near Hawara, when he was able to reach two settlers, one of whom is an officer in a special force in the army, and the other a student at the military college in the occupation army. These two settlers who were killed yesterday near Hawara, and the massacre that followed via arson and killing committed by settlers with the protection of the Israeli occupation army. So what do they think the Palestinian people will do when a knife is stuck in their neck? Resistance heroes come out from here and there in Al-Quds, Jenin and Nablus to defend their people, by searching for an opportunity in light of the repression and the security pressure exerted by this occupier. But no matter how strong this occupier is, his weaknesses remain. Its weaknesses lies in its strength, and the strength of the Palestinian people lie in their weakness. This equation is the equation of strategic patience and the preoccupation practiced by the Palestinian. Whether on the individual or factional level, that constitutes an incubator and amendable to steadfastness, confrontation and victory that will be achieved one day.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Jradad, author, academic and political commentator, for joining us from Jenin to talk about the Nablus massacre committed by the aggressor, the Zionist entity. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned because we are moving from Palestine to Lebanon, where a new British company has been found liable in the Beirut port explosion of 2020.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A British court has ruled a London-based company that delivered the explosive ammonium nitrate to Beirut's port is liable towards the victims of the devastating 2020 Beirut port blast, according to Lebanon's Lawyers Bar Association. On August 4 that year, hundreds of tons of the chemical typically used in fertilizers detonated, killing more than 218 people, injuring over 6,000 and damaging large parts of Beirut. Families of the explosion's victims saw the development as a rare step towards justice and against the political intervention that has obstructed the investigative judge leading a probe in Lebanon for over 2 years now. More details in this following report.
At a time when the political authority in Lebanon and its judicial affiliates are obstructing the progress of the investigation into the Beirut port explosion, a team of Lebanese lawyers achieved what they perceived as a small victory abroad in the process of searching for the truth and determining responsibilities. Their victory was registered against a British company known as Savaro Limited, which was responsible for supplying the shipment of ammonium nitrate that exploded in Ward No. 12 in the port of the capital Beirut, wreaking havoc in the city. According to the Telegraph newspaper, a chemical company registered in the United Kingdom was found responsible before the High Court in London for the Beirut port explosion that killed more than 200 people. The Beirut port explosion killed at least 218 people, including Lebanese citizens and others of different nationalities, and injured more than 7,000 others, and resulted in huge material losses estimated at billions of dollars. In return, the prosecution office of the Beirut Bar Association announced on Thursday, February 23, the issuance of the first judicial ruling outside Lebanon in the case of the port bombing that occurred on August 4, 2020. The Office of the Prosecution for the Port Explosion said in a statement, "The British High Court of Justice in London issued a ruling in favor of the victims represented by the Office of the Prosecution against the English company Savaro Limited, responsible for the shipment of ammonium nitrate that exploded in the port of Beirut, and that the second phase of the trial opened, which is the stage of determining the value of the compensation that will be due to the victims." But who is behind Savaro Limited? Savaro was established on June 9, 2006 in the British capital for the wholesale of chemical products. When searching for the details of the company, only the name of the Ukrainian businessman Hilyachenko is found, while all the other employees resigned successively between 2008 and 2021. An investigation by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project revealed that the company is a front company for a network of companies based in Dnipro, Ukraine, and part of a large project trading in technical-grade fertilizers that go into the manufacture of explosives. So who really is behind this company is still unknown. The Public Prosecution Office had filed a civil lawsuit in August 2021 against the London-registered Savaro Chemicals Company, which leased the ammonium nitrate shipment in 2013 to end up in Beirut. The company is owned by Ukrainian businessman Vladimir Hilyachenko and is run by a network of businessmen. To evade responsibility, the company attempted to liquidate its business and deregister itself from the British company's register 2 years ago. The evidence also showed the inaction of the Lebanese officials in the context of corruption and mismanagement by those in charge for a long time at the port, which allowed a chemical with such a high explosive potential to be stored there indiscriminately and in an unsafe manner for nearly 6 years, according to a report issued by Human Rights Watch. The organization indicated that many of Lebanon's senior leaders were informed of the dangers posed by ammonium nitrate, yet chose not to take the necessary measures to protect their people.
Now to discuss this topic with us from the state of Georgia is Chris Weaver, a co-host of Twice Told Tales. Thank you very much, Chris, for being with us to discuss this new so-called victory in Lebanon. But let's discuss if it is actually a victory or not. And now we have lawyer Professor Nasri Diab and lawyer Camille Abu Sulaiman, who are in charge of this lawsuit in the UK, emphasize the fundamental importance of this ruling at the UK High Court, as it is the first judicial decision to name one of those responsible for the 2020 catastrophe in Beirut, constituting the first judicially established incident, which, according to them, opens the door for the prosecution of other officials inside Lebanon. But against whom is this victory, Chris, if the founders of Savaro Limited are still up until now unknown?
Well, I mean, to me, it just seems like a show trial. It really immediately made me think of the 2018 New York case where Iran was forced basically to pay billions of dollars because America had seized the assets of Iran due to sanctions, and they just gave that money away in a court case because Iran is supposedly responsible for 9/11. So, I mean, you can have show trials that are politicized, and then the the people who are being prosecuted are basically immobilized. And in this case, we don't know the nature of this company. But I think more importantly, if you're, any of the people who potentially could be brought to trial based on this lawsuit or even in this lawsuit, is I don't think you even need a lawyer. I think you just need a high school chemistry teacher, because you need, in order for ammonium nitrate to be a high explosive, it has to be mixed uniformly with fuel oil. That's why it's called an ANFO bomb, ammonium nitrate fuel oil. The fuel oil part is very important. It can't just be a little spill of fuel oil at the port that may have touched some fertilizer. That's not, it needs to be very carefully mixed so it's homogenized. And how did that happen? That's not being explained. How did ammonium nitrate attracts water molecules? It's hydrophilic. So if you store it near the port for 6 years, it's going to be bricks. It's going to be unsellable as fertilizer, and it's going to be very difficult to mix with fuel oil. And whether the fuel oil would even work in that case because there's water there, it's just the whole story. And then you would need a explosive to set off that charge, like inside of it. That it doesn't, you can't just light it on fire. Anyone, go try and light your fertilizer on fire. It won't light. It's not. It's very stable.
So the theory that you are actually maybe leaning towards, Chris, is that there has been some sort of a planned detonation that happened that would allow such an amount of ammonium nitrate to explode.
I mean, it could be anything.
That's
the thing. Like.
But look, what's really interesting for me, Chris, is that with the information that was provided to us, which was less than a paragraph coming from this supposed UK court, I just surfed the internet for like 2 minutes to look about all around about what Savaro is and who's behind it, if there is actual evidence of who's behind it. But I saw that it's directly linked to Cypriot and Lithuanian businessmen residing in Nicosia, Cyprus. But the Lebanese prosecuting office somehow is being oriented towards three Russian Syrian businessmen who have been sanctioned, by the way, by the United States of America, these three businessmen in 2016 for allegedly being close to the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They are George Haswani, Mudallal Khoury, and Imad Khoury, who openly claimed in a report that is found online where they gave interviews to Reuters, and they said that they had no connections whatsoever to Savaro, but their company, their marine company that actually transports goods, is registered with the same agent company found in Cyprus. So we're going back to Cyprus and Ukraine for the actual basic source of where that ammonium nitrate came. But is this an attempt now to evade responsibility from real perpetrators who might actually have done something illegal in Lebanon and turn it into a political indictment against Syria? Or am I just being a bit paranoid here?
Well, I mean, anything could happen. Like, I personally think it's possible it was a missile strike. I mean, there were evidence of planes flying over the port at that moment. So that's possible. And then it's just a cover-up to prevent a larger war. But I think in this case, what you just said, it's obvious that just follow the money. I mean, where could you easily get money from people who aren't going to be able to complain? It's someone who's been sanctioned and their money is being held and frozen in bank accounts that can be, you know, that their money can just be turned over without any fight, without any ability for them to fight back. So that's exactly what they did with the Iranian government in 2018 with that court case. So it sounds logical to turn to the guys whose money is sanctioned and just take their money, basically. So they're just creating a pretext with a show trial to figure out how to get money out of some guy's bank accounts who can't fight
well,
back.
Well, as a Lebanese citizen myself here, Chris, one important question keeps popping in my head since there are links in this case that would lead to unveiling the truth behind who is really responsible in this national catastrophe that actually struck Lebanon. Why has the Beirut investigations in the explosion been frozen for the past 2.5 years now? And who's benefiting from actually hiding the truth if no one wants to be shown or portrayed as responsible? What's your take on that? Why do you think that the investigation was suspended?
Well, like I said, I think the whole story doesn't make sense from the beginning. The first time I heard it, I listened to it. And I was like, what? Because I know, I've used fertilizer all the time. Like, I've never been afraid of it. It's very stable. So mm-hmm. It makes no sense. And I there's got to be more to the story. So obviously they've covered it up because they don't want people looking at it. But I would just recommend just get some chemists, interview a chemist. I'm not a chemist, but interview a chemist to ask them how you could have ammonium nitrate explode without fuel oil. It doesn't work. So mm-hmm. I would say, you know, they're probably, sadly, I really respect Lebanon as a genuine component of the resistance access there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if this is a trial in which people in the Lebanese government know they're covering for Israeli missile strike and that they would, you know, prefer to do that rather than launch an all-out war, you know, I can understand that, but it's also kind of a depressing thought. So
definitely.
I don't know, but I would just encourage everyone involved, including the legal teams there, to ask better questions mm-hmm. because it doesn't make any sense.
Definitely, because I actually believe there's more sense in the questions that you actually asked, Chris, than the small paragraph that was initiated by the Beirut Bar of Association telling us that, yay, we won something against someone, but that someone is non-existent, and that something killed more than 200 people in Lebanon and put 7,000 humans in hospitals because of it. And I myself think that this is something bigger than what is being told in the media. But I want to thank you very much, Chris Waver, co-host of Twice Told Tales, for giving us the time and the energy to discuss this very pressing issue right now in Lebanon. And ladies and gents, I want to thank you very much. I'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. The latest government statistics show that the price of food in United Kingdom is increasing rapidly, and the continuing of the situation has seriously put the issue of food security in headlines. Rising food prices are a real concern in the United Kingdom, with studies showing that millions of consumers already skipping meals or struggling to put healthy meals on the table. We have taken a look at the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered this issue and tells us more. According to the latest figures released by market researcher Kantar on Tuesday, 28th of February, grocery prices in the United Kingdom have surged to a new record of 17.1% in the 4 weeks of February. Data showed milk, eggs and margarine are showing the fastest price growth. The report says food inflation in the country is at its highest since the firm started tracking the figures in 2008, adding £811 to the typical annual shopping bill and forcing British households to change their consumption habits. The head of retail and consumer insight at Kantar, Fraser McKevitt, said, "This February marks a full year since the monthly grocery inflation climbed above 4%. This is having a big impact on people's lives." He noted that surging food prices were the second most important financial issue for the public after energy costs, adding that one in four shoppers in Britain were now struggling financially. According to a BBC study, some essentials have almost doubled in price over the past 2 years. For example, a 500-gram bag of pasta that cost 50 pence 2 years ago is now priced at 95 pence. British families face an even tighter squeeze on their finances this year as the government cuts back support on household energy bills, while mortgage rates continue to rise, worsening the cost of living crisis. Economists say although overall inflation in the United Kingdom fell to 10.1% in January from its highest levels in more than 40 years, food prices are continuing to rise, forcing shoppers to turn to discounters. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The National Farmers Union has warned UK supermarket shelves have been left bare of fresh fruit and vegetables, particularly tomatoes and cucumbers, which could be the tip of the iceberg. Certain products are hard to come by in UK supermarkets due to poor weather, reducing the harvest in Europe and North Africa. Brexit rules and lower supplies from UK and Dutch producers hit by the jump in energy bills to heat glasshouses. Andrew Opie, Director of Food and Sustainability at the British Retail Consortium, said difficult weather conditions in the south of Europe and North Africa have disrupted harvest for some fruit and vegetables, including tomatoes. The British government has pointed the finger at poor weather conditions in Spain and Morocco, key exporting countries, as the main cause of the shortage. However, farmers blame other factors such as climate crisis, sky-high energy costs and Brexit. Tony Montalbano, a director of Greenacre Salads in Royden, Essex, typically produces 1 million kilograms of baby cucumbers a year, but his glasshouses were standing empty in recent days. He said he delayed growing his crops this year until March to avoid winter fuel bills of up to £500,000 a month. The British Tomato Growers Association also said recently that many of its members have also delayed their crop season by 2 or 3 weeks to avoid high heating bills. Elizabeth Webster, chair of the campaign group Save British Food, said Brexit compounded many food supply problems because farmers in mainland Europe find it easier to sell within the European Union than face the extra paperwork by transporting produce in short supply to the United Kingdom. Elizabeth Webster added, "The government is getting rid of our food security and relying on imports while cutting off links to Europe." British News of The Guardian continues by saying, Tim Lang, Emeritus Professor of Food Policy at City, University of London, and the author of Feeding Britain, said, "Our supply chains are creaking and we're seeing a forerunner of what could be a huge crisis. There has been a total failure by the government to develop a proper food strategy." Professor Tim Lang said, "It is absurd to be increasingly relying on fresh produce grown more than 1,000 miles away in places such as North Africa, while UK production is being wound down. It is not just food that is at risk in complex supply chains. There have been shortages of cold and flu medications, as some pharmacists rely on drugs from China and India." The National Farmers Union's Deputy President, Tom Bradshaw, said reliance on imports had left the UK particularly exposed to shock weather events. He also acknowledged the current shortage was an indirect result of Brexit and the war in Ukraine. Britain relies on Morocco, the Netherlands and Spain for tomatoes over winter. Importers have become increasingly reliant on Morocco in the wake of Brexit, which has slowed the trade in fresh produce with Europe. However, crops in Morocco have been poor this year after flooding and cold temperatures. Surging fertilizer prices in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war have also hit yields. Harvests in Spain have also been weak following persistent cold spells. According to figures from the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, pressure on supply has led to rising prices, with the cost of a kilogram of tomatoes rising from £2.09 in January 2020 to £2.96 last month. Prices have risen particularly sharply since the start of last year. According to the figures from Office of National Statistics, in January of 2023, annual food price inflation in the United Kingdom hit 16.7%, which was the highest rate since at least 1977. The website of Press TV has also covered this issue and tells us more. Supermarket giants in the United Kingdom are now only allowing 3 tomatoes and other salad ingredients per customer, and where there is availability, you have to pay a premium, especially for out-of-season fresh produce. 2022 was the second hottest year ever on record in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem has also affected countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the United Kingdom has its own well-established food industry, one important component of which is greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay bare. Economics professor Keith Pilbeam said, "There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive." He said another problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing, so it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets, adding, "And so, rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all." And the United Kingdom faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and vegetables come from the European Union. The country's exit from the European bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods. Professor Keith Pilbeam noted Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. He said more bureaucracy and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profit, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that. Food-producing organisations say the solution is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilisers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A new round of political maneuvering by the International Atomic Energy Agency has enabled Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin to further pressure Iran towards their ulterior motives. Once again, the IAEA has entangled Iran in a dispute triggered by the agency's Israeli influence accusations, which were leveled against Tehran's peaceful nuclear activities at Fordo Fuel Enrichment Plant, located near the Iranian city of Qom. Back in 2018, former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from the landmark nuclear deal and then unleashed a wave of illegal sanctions on Iran's economy. In response, Tehran has since ramped up uranium enrichment at a considerable pace not seen since the signing of Iran nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. An ardent opponent of Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, Joe Biden's administration began negotiations to revive the deal when he took office. But Biden's policy has so far failed to resurrect the 2015 accord. The negotiations to salvage the JCPOA have been at a standstill since August 2022 due to Washington's insistence on its hard-nosed position of not removing all the sanctions that were imposed on the Islamic Republic by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran's main demands include guarantees from Washington that future U.S. administrations will not renege on the nuclear accord once again. Iran insists that it wants a stronger language in the draft text to ensure there are no ambiguities. In addition, Iran says any agreement concerning the reviving of the nuclear deal also hinges on the settlement of safeguards issues, and without settling those issues, reviving the 2015 nuclear deal makes no sense. For a closer analysis, please stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. The Global Nuclear Agency, IAEA, made a confidential report a few days ago, which was leaked by Western media in violation of legal protocols. The IAEA chief reacted to the leakage, saying it was regrettable, but refusing to take responsibility for it. In the report, Grossi had accused Iran of making an undeclared change to the interconnection between the two clusters of advanced machines enriching uranium to up to 60% purity at its Fordo plant. The U.S. and its European allies issued a joint statement following the leakage of the mentioned report, accusing Iran of being inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
This is, very much the nature of the director, and he's very much in the pocket of the Western governments. When the Western governments tell him to do something, he does that. So tomorrow he could be very nice to Iran because of the dictate that he gets, or he could be very harsh to Iran because of the dictate that he gets. And this is sad because the International Atomic Energy Agency is a UN body. It's supposed to be neutral. It shouldn't engage in double standards. The previous directors of the International Atomic Energy Agency also in line with Western policies against Iran. But Mr. Grossi is gross in terms of how he acts. There is no other way to explain that.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, dismissed the report by calling it incorrect and reiterated the fact that the IAEA reports are not published immediately by the media about any country except Iran. He also urged Rafael Grossi to maintain professional behavior and not be part of the politically motivated pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. The remarks came a week after Iran had criticized the agency over its confidential report, claiming that the accusation came despite a letter sent by Iran to the IAEA back in November, informing the agency of a decision to start enriching uranium to the purity level of 60% at its Fordo nuclear facility, and stating all the modes of enrichment that had been specified in the data questionnaire. Consistently during the January 2023 IAEA inspection, no new measure had happened that was contradictory to the November 17, 2022 questionnaire and would thus make it necessary to inform the IAEA thereof. The latest clash on Fordo comes as IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi had said last month he hopes to visit Tehran in February to hold talks with Iranian officials on the unresolved cases of nuclear particles found years ago at several Iranian sites. Iranian officials have emphasized that any trip by the IAEA head to Iran must have a specific objective in an oblique reference to the UN nuclear agency's political approach. They insist that the trip needs preparations and the content, the aims, and the schedule of which needs to be clearly determined in advance. The agency says that Tehran has to provide technically credible answers to its questions. On its part, Iran accuses the agency of being easily influenced by Israel, a staunch critic of the JCPOA. Therefore, the Iranian officials have demanded that the IAEA probe be dropped before Iran rejoins the nuclear deal.
Mr. Netanyahu is trying to become the main player in this controversy and challenge. Please note that today, when we are talking to each other, both the Americans and Europeans are not satisfied with the negotiations process in this case. And that means they want to take it in a different direction. Why? This is a very important question. The reason is that it is no secret Iran is progressing in the nuclear technology every day. I mean, every day we announce that we have gained this or that achievement. In the next phase, we have another achievement, and all of them will be realized and announced under the supervision of the agency. It is all peaceful. So this was the first point. The next point is that these achievements are not limited to nuclear areas only. They happen every day in military areas and in Iran's missile power.
In June, the IAEA censured Iran for traces of uranium that had been found at three undeclared sites in 2019. Iran dismissed the IAEA motion as politicized and responded by removing surveillance cameras at key sites. Tehran says that the probe is based on forged evidence provided to the IAEA by the Israeli regime. It has slammed the agency for adopting a political approach and forsaking its technical mandate while maintaining that its nuclear program is strictly peaceful.
You know, it is something very amazing that the Israelis engage in assassinating Iranian scientists. They sabotage Iranian sites. They engage in a lot of activities that are against international law. And the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency visits Israel before coming to Iran.
On Iran's side, there is this very important point that time is moving forward in Iran's favor. It means that if one day we were talking about IR-1 or IR-2, today we are talking about more advanced centrifuges. If one day our concern was if we had the permission to establish this or that nuclear plant, today we build various plants under the supervision of the IAEA. If one day we were under pressure about our regular missiles, today they are worried about Iran's long-range missiles.
Iran has time and again rejected accusations of seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The country, which is an abiding member of the NPT, has agreed to put certain limits on its nuclear program by signing the JCPOA and has allowed unprecedented levels of inspections by the IAEA to reassure the world that it is not after nuclear weapons.
Due to the fact that some Western parties and those who were influenced by the Zionists published doubts about our nuclear program, we came to the conclusion to provide appropriate answers to these doubts through cooperation with the agency. We try to continue allowing the IAEA inspectors to monitor our facilities during various programs, both within the framework of the nuclear safeguards and after that, during the time when we accepted the JCPOA restrictions and supervisions. We created the possibility of high-level access for the agency in our own nuclear sites, and the IAEA has announced 15 times so far that it has not observed any deviation in Iran's nuclear program.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has also issued a religious decree declaring that the accusation, development, and use of nuclear weapons violate Islamic principles and are therefore forbidden. However, in response to the latest developments in the nuclear case, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, said, "Despite ill promises and obstructions created by the U.S. and E3, we remain committed to fulfilling our international obligations, but it will be within purely technical frameworks." Adding, "Under such a framework, we remain committed to negotiation to achieve tangible and practical results to first, secure maximum national interest, and second, give care to joint interests with other parties."
The Western parties suspended their commitments in the JCPOA. Contrary to the United Nations resolution, America withdrew from this agreement and did not lift the sanctions. The Europeans also failed to fulfill their obligations. In the same framework, Iran also limited its commitments in a compensatory measure and temporarily limited inspections of the IAEA. Of course, we are of the opinion that if these suspensions end, i.e., the other side is ready to lift the sanctions again, Iran is also ready to return to its obligations and allow the previous monitoring.
Accordingly, the Iranian government insists on negotiations, not merely for the sake of negotiations, but for obtaining collective results and achievements. They are seriously and categorically critical of those who have used negotiations for political and partisan games in the West. Talks to restore the nuclear deal remain deadlocked since September, with the U.S. publicly maintaining that the matter is not important to them anymore, while Tehran claims Washington is secretly sending messages to reach an agreement.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here's how it looks on the page. The National News reads, IAEA chief touts alternative to Iran nuclear deal to break impasse. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog has suggested an alternative agreement to the landmark Iran nuclear deal could break the deadlock in talks between the regime and world powers. Rafael Grossi, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said the coming weeks and months would be crucial in determining the direction the talks take. Mr. Grossi warned the Chatham House think tank in London on Tuesday against adopting a defeatist approach to the signatories' sluggish efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. "I think in the case of Europe, it is very important that they continue to support us in trying to find a viable way forward, JCPOA or no JCPOA." According to Financial Times, West grapples with dilemma over Iran nuclear talks. The U.S., U.K., and EU impose new sanctions on dozens of Iranian officials and entities in their latest attempt to increase the pressure on Tehran. The U.K. is also reviewing whether to proscribe the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, while the European Parliament has called for the blacklisting of the most powerful wing of the Republic's state security forces. Yet, even as relations touch new lows, U.S. and European officials are keeping the door open to diplomacy to save what is left of the moribund 2015 nuclear deal Tehran signed with world powers. That is not because they are optimistic about a breakthrough. There have been no nuclear talks since Iran rejected a draft proposal to revive the deal agreed by the accord's other signatories in September. Instead, it is a reflection of the dilemma Western powers face as they consider their limited options to stop Iran from expanding its nuclear program. On the one hand, they fear that pulling the plug on the nuclear diplomacy would hand Iran a propaganda victory by enabling it to blame the West for the collapse. They are also weary of triggering a broader crisis by ending all avenues of diplomacy with Tehran, diplomats and analysts say. CNBC says Iranian oil exports end 2022 at a high despite no nuclear deal. Iranian oil exports hit new highs in the last 2 months of 2022 and are making a strong start to 2023 despite U.S. sanctions, according to companies that track the flows on higher shipments to China and Venezuela. There is no definitive figure for Iranian oil exports, and estimates often fall into a wide range. Tanker tracking companies use various methods to track the flows, including satellite data, port loading data, and human intelligence. Iran generally does not release figures. According to another analyst, Vortexa, Chinese December imports of Iranian oil hit a new record of 1.2 million barrels per day, up 130% from a year earlier. Qatari Deputy Premier and Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed ibn Abdulrahman Al Thani on January 29th traveled to Iran and met with Chief Diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the Iranian capital. The U.S. has sent a message to Iran, he cryptically told a press conference in Tehran.
As we got closer to the end of the negotiations, two things happened. The first thing is that these pressures have increased. This is from America and Europe. They increased the pressure, they increased the sanctions, they put more people on the sanctions list, they strengthened different areas that put pressure on Iran. They travel to different countries and talk to the world leaders against Iran. The second thing that we usually witness is the invisible hand of the terrorist groups, which are always ready to serve. I mean, if they can't stop the process of negotiations and the parties are close to yielding results, they try to assassinate someone in Iran, a scientist. Do something like this to deviate the negotiations' results. Of course, it should be mentioned that they always pay the price. Every time they assassinate someone here in Iran or do acts of vandalism, Iran responds strongly.
Local media in Iran viewed the American message as somewhat of a victory. On the other hand, some analysts insist that the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as JCPOA, is not a priority for the Joe Biden administration.
Biden administration could return to the agreement on the first day of Biden's presidency, the same way he returned to the Paris Climate Accords. Trump left these international accords through executive orders. Biden could return to these accords, just nullifying the executive order of the previous president. And he did that, but not for JCPOA. Why he didn't return to JCPOA? Because of the disagreements that existed in his administration even before. And what he could do was to return to JCPOA, it was Trump that left it, and then tell Iran you have 2 months or 3 months to return to the setting that Iran had before Trump left the agreement. Easy solution. You don't need negotiations, you don't need 2 years of dragging your foot, you could just return to the agreement. And when Biden became president, Rouhani was in office in Iran. Rouhani was even more interested in returning to the agreement.
Without elaborating, the Qatari foreign minister stated that he was carrying a message from the U.S. about a topic related to the 2050 nuclear agreement. Amir Abdullahian confirmed that he had received the message, but did not say what it entailed.
The United States could do things to show that they're actually serious about observing the guidelines of JCPOA. For example, the one thing that needs to happen after the agreement, if U.S. returns to the agreement, is that you have companies, international companies, that want to come and invest in Iran. And if companies think that they will face sanctions in a few months, a couple of years after Biden leaves office, then they may not come because of this uncertainty. Again, doesn't make sense for Iran to follow the agreement if the next president does what Trump did. And who knows, you know, we have people like Mike Pompeo who are planning to run. John Bolton is planning to run. So obviously these people, Trump may come back to the White House. We never know.
The Iranian foreign minister told reporters that he had complained to his Qatari counterpart about the unconstructive role and interventionist measures of the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany during the recent unrest in Iran. Local newspapers saw the American message as a sign that the West had lost faith in the potential for success of the recent unrest in Iran. Some accused the West of hypocrisy and insisted that the so-called Plan B to pressure the Islamic Republic into agreeing to restore the JCPOA had failed.
There is another event that has actually changed the political arrangement about nuclear negotiations a bit, and that is the result of the events that started in mid-September. This was very decisive. Everyone noticed that when the riots broke out in Iran and conditions became volatile, the speed of the negotiations process dropped sharply and almost came to a halt. The reason was that the other side felt Iran was in an unstable condition politically and the government has lost its nation's support. It was a key moment and big lesson for the Iranian nation. Negotiations practically froze. It is not the first time, however, that we experienced something like this. In the previous rounds of negotiations, whenever anything happened in Iran, they would immediately stop negotiations, hoping that such unrest can force Iran into giving more concessions. This is how they think, but they need to know that it will never happen, and Iran will never succumb to such pressures.
Tehran has repeatedly indicated that negotiation and diplomacy with the ultimate objective of achieving joint interests and securing maximum benefits for the Iranian nation are placed high on its agenda.
From my point of view, negotiations can be concluded very quickly. The negotiations have reached the stage where the draft text is almost ready, except for one or two paragraphs on the issue of cooperation between Iran and the agency. The rest of the issues are close to a conclusion, and for this reason, we think that if the other party has a realistic approach and is ambitious, it's possible to reach the result faster. The thing that interrupted the negotiations has political backgrounds, and the other side can be blamed for it on this matter.
Within the framework of Iran's foreign policy doctrine, in terms of dynamic diplomacy and smart interaction, Iran has prioritized the view to Asia as well as the immediate neighbors as its main approach. Yet, Tehran has made serious efforts concurrently to enhance cooperation with Africa, Europe, the Americas, including Latin America. The government believes that Europe is not made up of only three countries that have acted unfriendly towards Iran, especially in recent months. In fact, the establishment seeks to expand relations worldwide as part of the agenda to advance its interests. In light of the recent IAEA moves, some independent political analysts have observed that, unfortunately, instrumental use of international organizations against independent countries has turned into a norm in the West's foreign policy.
When we provide this level of access to the agency investigators, this level of preparedness and response to the agency questions, why does the agency keep asking new questions? How long are these new questions going to be raised? From our point of view, more cooperation should lead to a greater understanding, but what has happened so far is that we cooperate, we provide opportunities for the agency secretariat, and they always raise questions. This approach is not fair and strongly frowned upon by the Iranian nation. The agency's recent report was in the same framework.
One side of the story, there is Netanyahu, who is trying to influence the director general of the IAEA, a person who has apparently become the agent of these political events. On the other side, America and Europe are not willing to confront Iran and have come to the understanding that such conflicts never benefit them. What they want today is to freeze and stop Iran's actions. They don't seek to shut down Iran's nuclear program because they know that they don't have the power. They want to reach an agreement that will at least convince Iran to suffice to this extent of enrichment, so that Iran does not go further. Another side of the story is Iran. In Iran, no one has any objection to sitting behind the negotiating table. However, according to the same principles that have been said many times, we are not negotiating over new issues under the pretext of JCPOA. We are not negotiating on the regional issues or Iran's missile power.
In the meantime, in reaction to EU's chief diplomat Joseph Borrell's recent remarks about the revival of the JCPOA, Iran has made it clear that it would return to its commitments under the nuclear deal whenever the parties to the JCPOA fulfill their obligations. Iran has proven in the past that it will never give in to pressure and will go on with its peaceful nuclear program proportionate to its own needs and in line with its rights and obligations under international treaties to which it is a member. As an effective and responsible member of the agency and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and as a country possessing nuclear capabilities, nuclear knowledge, and nuclear technology, the Islamic Republic of Iran has always cooperated seriously and effectively with the agency. Enemies of the Islamic Republic attempt to show that Iran does not need nuclear technology and claim that Iran is seeking atomic bombs. However, the Iranian nuclear chief has categorically rejected the enemy's claims that the country does not need nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and seeks to achieve military weapons. In an interview with a local media during the inauguration ceremony of the Narigan uranium mine, Islami said Iran's recent nuclear achievements are meant to be used in the health, medical, environmental, and industry sectors, reiterating the peaceful nature of the country's uranium enrichment activities. Also, Islami described Narigan mine as the biggest uranium molybdenum mine in the country and said that creating the capacity with the aim of expanding nuclear power production and